Hi, my name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And believe me, I'd much rather go to the sobriety countdown than to stand up here. When I before the meeting began, Lorene and I were sitting back here, and we didn't have these. We ran and got them, and they said, "Now we can go down and count down to our execution." And that's, oh God, I'm 24 and a half years sober, but I've never ever got. Oh, well, thank you. I've never ever gotten used to speaking. It's just like, oh. And this morning, I was sitting on the sofa trying to meditate and think a little bit about what I was going to say. Of course, I've been thinking about it for weeks. If the truth be told. So this morning, I was sitting on the sofa trying to not think about what I was going to say. And so I put on my headphones and was listening to a little, you know, meditative music or something. And my hands started sweating, and I looked at the clock, and it was 11:13, and I thought, oh God, and they're still sweating, and they'll be sweating until this is all over. But I cannot tell you, on February 27th, 1983, when I walked into my first meeting, was sort of dragged into my first meeting, not knowing I was an alcoholic, and said, "My name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic," the freedom that was to come with those first words, "I am an alcoholic." Oh my God, that surrender. I have in this program learned that surrender is not losing. Surrender is moving over to the winning side. And that's what we've done. We've moved over to the winning side. Now, I didn't know how hard it was going to be, how much work was going to be involved. Stopping drinking was the easy part. It was the changing and going on that was the hard part. I came from Wyoming. I hate to say this in front of all you people, but I'm going to be 67 on the 4th of July, and it just... Well, you can celebrate it, I don't. But anyway, I get up in the morning and I feel 27 until I get to the bathroom mirror and something's happened in between. But anyway, I was born and raised in Wyoming. And I came from a violent alcoholic home, and there was a lot of chaos. My father would beat up my mother and sometimes us, and he was a compulsive gambler. Before I was born, but my two sisters were alive, he lost our home in a poker game, and they had to move into a rental house until couldn't afford another house until I was 9. So there's a lot of chaos around it, and I was always ashamed of myself and always hiding and doing. And it's amazing when Lorene was talking about the fear and the anxiety and on the suicide and the depression. I thought, that girl is telling my story. She's 3 centuries younger than I am, and she's come from another part of the world, but it was my story, listening about the fear and the depression. I took my first drink when I was 14, and it wasn't the first drink, it was drunk. I just got absolutely, totally wasted. And I started drinking then, and I never stopped. When I was 15, I sort of lost the draw, and I had to go in and try to buy alcohol for my buddies. If I had any, I don't remember. And so I put on my father's suit. Oh, you're way ahead of me, I can see that. I put on his shoes, his white shirt, a tie. I put on his glasses, and he had one of those hats, like that white hat down there, but it was a felt hat. And I'm 15, mind you. So I go into the Green Mill on Front Street in Rawlins, Wyoming. And there was a bar, and then there was, there was a packaged goods store, then there was a bar, and then there was pool tables, and there was poker tables in the back. Wyoming was wide open those days. And so I shuffle up to the package goods thing, and the guy comes up and he says, "May I help you?" And I said, "I'd like a fifth of Tavares vodka, please." So he gets and he puts it in a bag, and he comes up and he puts it on the thing, and I count out my change. It was $2.08 or something like that. And I really lowered my voice and I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Oh, that's okay, sonny." So. I never had trouble, unfortunately, getting liquor after that, and I just drank. I was in such pain and shame and all that stuff. I was this 96-pound weakling, you know, and all that stuff, and just hiding all the time and hated high school and nearly flunked out, and I went away to college and just drank, and I flunked out in my sophomore year. I joined the Army. I tried to commit suicide 3 times in college and high school, and uh, I uh, then when I was in the army, I started drinking again. I was in Germany, and I tried to commit suicide there, and the attempted suicide is not a recreational activity on which the army looks with much favor. So they kicked me out, and they put me on a boat. I was in Germany. They put me on a boat and sent me back to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I was not going to go back to Wyoming in all that shame. And I got on the bus from Fort Dix, and I came to New York City. I had no idea. I knew nobody here. I had $270 in my pocket, and I have now been here since it was St. Patrick's Day of 1961. And I drank until I was 42, and I eventually got into the theater, and without knowing it, I had something of a wonderful life and a little bit of a career and things like that. But it all just slipped away. And when I was 42, I was throwing a party. I hadn't produced, I became a producer, and I hadn't produced a show in 4 or 5 years, and just had no idea what to do with my life. I was hideously in debt and just in despair, and I couldn't pick up the phone and call anybody. At night in the bars, between the hours of 10 in the evening and 4 in the morning, I was a fantastic creative producer. But at 10 o'clock in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, when you're supposed to be doing business, I couldn't get out of bed, I couldn't pick up the phone, I couldn't do anything because I was just so ashamed, and I knew nobody wanted to talk to me, nobody wanted to see me, nobody liked me, nobody, you know, just all that less than that we all, most of us felt. And then one day I was throwing a party because I didn't know what else to do, and this young kid that I was trying to get to come to my party said, "No, Bob, I can't come because I don't drink anymore." And I said, "Oh, that's okay, Norman, lots of my friends don't drink." Now, I couldn't have named any of them. But he said, "No, I'm an alcoholic, and I joined AA, and I've been sober for 6 months." And I didn't understand for years why I said what I said next, but I said, "Norman, I think I need help." Because never once did it ever occur to me that I had a drinking problem in all those years, never once. Norman talked to me for 5 days and finally got me to go to an AA meeting with him. And thank God, I never had to go out for any refresher courses. And then it became about facing Bob Kalaly without, well, so much for my anonymity now. It came facing myself without the drink and without the buffer and the shame and all that stuff. And it was just like, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to work. I was so much in debt. I owed $100,000 and I didn't know how to pay the rent or anything like that. And I was borrowing money. And there I was in AA, and the only place I felt safe. So I went to 5 meetings a day. I wasn't working. The only place I felt safe was in the meetings. And little by little, hope came back into my life. And when hope comes into your life, despair starts to go away, and depression starts to go away. And it begins to change. And change was such an incredibly important thing. I was a hard one. I mean, I kept thinking I had to throw parties and things like that. So even though I wasn't drinking, I had to entertain my friends and be Bob and duh. And I didn't get rid of the liquor in my house for a year and a half. And then one day I woke up in the middle of the night sweating and whatever. I had this dream that I was sitting in the closet where all the liquor was, drinking a bottle of that wonderful red wine. So I called my sponsor, who I had not told in 18 months that I had all this liquor in my house. And he suggested I get rid of it. It took me another 3 weeks, but one day I got it all out in the kitchen. And, you know, the more I've told this story, the more bottles there were. But there were... But I promise you, it's at least, I don't know, 6 or 8 cases, and there was beer and champagne and all that kind of stuff. And I had all these open bottles, and some of them. So I poured the open bottles down the drain. And then I just looked at all this other stuff on the floor that was just, you know, brand new, thousands of dollars, you know, worth of liquor. And I thought, I can't do this. What am I going to do? I can't pour this down the drain. This is such a waste. What? Get it out of the house. So I took it out into the hall in these boxes. And this woman was holding the elevator. She said, "Do you want the elevator?" And I said, no. So she went down. And then I went over and got the elevator and came up. And I put all this liquor in the elevator. And I thought, well, where am I going? So I punched the one button, and I stepped off the elevator, and the door closed, and the liquor went down, and I don't know whatever happened to it. Mm. Mm. I shared that in meetings one time, and somebody said, you know, you're going to be at an AA meeting sometime, and some guy's going to come up and say, I hit my bottom when this elevator door opened, and there's all this liquor. And then you have to face your past, you know, the fourth step. And what an incredible experience the fourth and the fifth step were, because it was hard, it was hard. And then doing the amends, but it was so important to get that stuff behind me. I was thinking this morning, it just came to me in bed, not about this or anything, a couple of little amends, things that I did when I was a teenager that I don't know where the people are, I have no idea, no clue, whatever, and I can't make amends to them and I don't know. Those things rankle now, even today, more than all the other really horrible stuff that I did that I've made amends for. These tiny little things. One time I stole $4 from somebody that really needed the $4. I wanted to buy a bottle with it. This woman trusted me. You know, I used to babysit her kids and things like this. It kills me to think that I can't go and find her and whatever. Anyway, you find out you need to change. And one day, I was 5 years sober, and I remember it was the fifth step, 5 years, and there was a step meeting, and I was there, and we were reading the book, and you know, you passed along. And there in the book, it came to me to read this one paragraph, and it was like that white light experience. And just the one sentence that stuck with me was, To those who have made progress in AA, it amounts to a clear recognition of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we can be. And I thought, my God, that's what this is all about. Who I am and who I am not. And to go on to become all that I can be. And that's what I've been doing for these 25 years. Trying to be more. Trying to be so much more. And I got to tell you something. I went home one time to make some amends to my neighbors. I'd stolen $30 from them also, their kids' money, the money that they had saved to buy their kids' bicycles, and I stole it in high school when I was 16 to buy liquor. And they figured out it was me, and they confronted me, and I denied it, and they confronted my parents, and I denied it so successfully that my parents didn't believe them. My father gave them back $30 and said whatever, but I didn't speak to these people for 30 years, and neither did my parents. And when I got sober, I realized that not only had I done this and needed to go and make amends to these people who I loved dearly, they were so wonderful to me, that I had lost the 30 years of their friendship for that. So I flew out to Wyoming, and I went and I met them. The wife didn't remember it through her alcoholism and all of her depression and shock therapy and all that stuff. She didn't have a clue. She thought I hadn't spoken to her because she hadn't sent me Christmas cards. But the husband remembered, and when I started to tell him, he said, oh, well, Pop. And I said, no, I've come here 2,000 miles to do this, and you're going to have to let me do it whether you want to listen to it or not. So I told him how sorry I was and how sorry I was for the friendship. Now, my folks had moved from Wyoming out to Salt Lake many, many, many years before that. And I was going out. My dad was dead. He died before I ever got sober. And my mother was still living out there in Salt Lake, so I went. I was going to go out and visit her for several days. And on the way driving out there, I thought, oh, my God, I've only made half this amends. My mother didn't speak to these people either. And if I don't tell her that they were right and I did this, I've only made half this amends. I wanted to turn around and drive right back to where I'd come from without going to Salt Lake. But I went on just, and I walked in the house there. And I put my stuff in the bedroom, and I thought, now, you either go out and you do this now, or you're going to have to do it tomorrow, or you're going to have to do it the next day. You're going to be here for 10 days, and every day you don't do it. And if you go back to New York City without having made this amends, without telling your mother, you're going to. Sick to my stomach, I went out in the living room. I said, Mother, there's something I need to tell you. So I told her this story, and she cringed, and she said, oh, my God, why did you have to tell them? Oh, what? So I went back in the bedroom and unpacked and thought, oh, God, how am I, you know, I have to go out and face the, you know. And my mother's a good woman. I went back out into the living room, and she was sitting there, and she said, you know, I've been thinking about what you just told me. And that's wonderful. That's really incredible, and I'm very proud of you. She said it took a lot of courage to do that, and it was an incredible experience. That was the first amends I made, and I was, you know, I was fairly newly sober. And since then, I have made many, many, many amends. And since then, I've gone on this journey of exploration to find out who I am. The four-step, I remember, was such an incredible experience because when I was drinking, I had this friend who was much older than I was, and he had this big, beautiful house in Staten Island. He had a living, you know, kitchen as big as this whole thing. And in this kitchen, he had sofas, and there was cooking area and tables and blah, this great, big, beautiful oriental rug that was on this kitchen floor. And for years, we drank and partied and, you know, everything you can imagine on that rug. Oh, you guys have dirty minds. But it's true, that happened on the rug too. So anyway, he was retiring, moving to Puerto Rico, and I went out to help him, and it fell to me to roll this rug up and get it ready for shipping. And I went down, and I tried to get the ends of this rug, and I couldn't move it. I couldn't budge it. So finally, I sort of got a loose end, and I grabbed this rug, and I popped it, trying to get it off the floor. This beautiful old oriental rug just shredded. Just, it popped, and all the wonderful threads and the cottons and the color just shredded. I was just amazed. And we laughed, and he threw the rug away and whatever. When I got sober and did the fourth and the fifth step and started looking at my life, the image of that rug came, because when I tried to look at my life when I got sober, I realized without me noticing it, my life had disintegrated like that rug. And the first time I tried to shake it or move it, but I can tell you there's a new rug under these feet now, and you know it, and it's just been an incredible experience. Somebody up here talked about the stories. Coming in and hearing the stories in these rooms, it's your stories that showed me the way. It's your stories that let me know that I could get better. We're healed by the stories that we hear in these rooms. I went into a meeting one day, and there was this 35-year-old young guy, and it was his 35th birthday. He had quit his job that afternoon of 35 years old, of 21 years as a gravedigger in a cemetery in the Bronx. He'd started helping his father when he was 14. His father was an Irish immigrant. 35 years, he quit his job that afternoon, went home and told his mother he was gay, and then he came to an AA meeting and shared it. And it was just the courage. And there was a woman I heard, and he was sober, and there was a woman I heard who was 16 years sober. She was drunk out of her mind as a young mother, and she was cooking dinner one night and had this big pot of pasta, hot water boiling on the stove, and her 18-month-old daughter was crawling around on the floor beside her, and she picked up this pot, and in her drunken whatever, stupor, she dropped the pot of water on her child and killed her 18-month-old child. And she was 16 years sober now, and she had been able to get through that. And these are the lights that we see. I was at a meeting one time, and a 73-year-old man said, if I live till June 5th, I'll be 73, and I'm graduating from Hunter College. These are the stories that heal us. I was walking down the library shortly after Hermina called me and informed me that I had to speak here. I thought she'd made a mistake. Anyway, I was walking down the sidewalk near the library, and I looked down, and there was a plaque on the library, on the sidewalk near the library, and it said, "The universe is made of stories, not atoms." And it's so true for me, because it's your stories that have helped me get sober. And I just want to close by telling you, when I got sober, I used to hear people sitting in these meetings and say, "Hi, my name's Bob, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic." And I thought, oh my God, give me a break. And you would hear it over and over again. And, you know, my resentment got bigger and bigger and bigger, just like the number of bottles in that story. Anyway, one day when I was about 18 months sober, I was listening to the CBS News with Dan Rather one night. And they had just discovered a thing called post-polio syndrome. And it was about 35 years after they discovered the cure of polio. And people who had polio and been in wheelchairs had learned how to walk and recovered a little bit, and people who'd been in iron lungs were able to get out and breathe and whatever. And now, all over the country, they had discovered that nerve endings and things are beginning to deteriorate again. I'm not sure on, you know, I'm not sure what, and I'm not sure of all the scientific background of this thing. But it was in the news. And people who had been able to walk on crutches were having to go back into wheelchairs, and people were having to go back on respirators. And people who were ambulatory were losing some of their ability to get around. And they were interviewing a woman who was probably about 50, and she'd had polio when she was 16, and she'd been in an iron lung. And while she was lying there in this hospital or reconstruction, whatever they called it, she tried to continue her education. So she started taking languages, and she learned Spanish, and then she learned French, and then she learned German. And she was able to get out and to get on a respirator, and she was able to graduate from high school, and then she was able to go to college, and she got her BS in languages, and she got her master's in languages. And she was in a wheelchair, and she was able to get married in a wheelchair, and she had a couple of children in the wheelchair, and she'd gone on to teach at college. And now she was back on a respirator and in the wheelchair, which she could only operate with her fingers. And they said to her, so blah, blah about this post-polio syndrome. What do you feel about this? You must have some feelings about it. And this woman said, I don't know if you'll understand what I'm going to tell you, but I think I'm grateful that I had polio, because if I hadn't had polio, I don't think I would have done as much with my life as I have done. And I understood that moment. Why people are grateful to be recovering alcoholics. Because if I hadn't been an alcoholic and if I hadn't gotten sober, I would not have done as much with my life as I have done. And I'm 67 years old, and I get up every morning full of expectation, and I'm still doing it. So I want to thank you for helping me on this journey. God bless you for being here for me today.